Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm here to introduce the introducer. But before I do that, I wanted to point out that we have two very nice young professionals that have been joining us for the past several months, and I wanted to ask you to help me join in welcoming them and to convince them to become members. So we have Erica Opkenorth, she works for the Near the West Side Initiative, and we have Emily Barrett, who works for Home Headquarters. So thank you both for coming and welcome. Okay, so most of you know Andrea Wandersee. She is a TMR member, but she is also the managing director of the Open Hand Theater. Andrea has over 20 years of professional experience in higher education, healthcare, nonprofit management, and consulting. She has an MPA from the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs and a BA in history from Hartwick College. Andrea?
Good morning. Thanks for being here today. I'm really delighted to be introducing this, I won't say panel because we're going to be giving individual presentations and then answering questions at the end. But I've been with Open Hand Theater for about a year and a half, and I'm a little bit new to arts management. It's been really exciting for me to get to know this community and a lot of the great leaders who are making such a wonderful difference here in Central New York. So it's my pleasure to introduce Steve Butler. He's the executive director of CNY Arts. He's a native of Onondaga County and received his Bachelor of Arts in Theater from Oswego State. He then spent some time in New York City. While he was in New York City, he did a number of things. He was in leadership positions at the Alliance of Residence Theaters, the Alliance of New York State Arts Councils, and several producing organizations. He was also an Actors Equity Association stage manager. Steve's a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship recipient in strategic planning, which is near and dear to my heart. He returned to Syracuse and obtained a Master of Arts in Public Administration from the Maxwell School. Yay, Maxwell School. He's currently the executive director of CNY Arts, which serves six counties throughout the state funding re-grant programs and technical assistance, among other services. So he works with all of our arts organizations, giving us, you know, much-needed dollars, but also other kinds of help and support. Steve served on many grant-making panels, including the National Endowment for the Arts, the New York State Council on the Arts, Arts Westchester, and the Initiative to Develop and Engage Audience and Services. He's an adjunct professor at Lemoyne College's Graduate Arts Administration Program and a guest lecturer who has presented at many schools, including the Herbert H. Humphrey Fellows Enhancement Conference at the Maxwell School, the SU Drama Department, and at SUNY Oswego's Graduate Marketing Program. So welcome, Steve. Our next speaker will be Elizabeth Dunbar, and she joined the Everson Museum of Art in late 2014. She's the institution's 10th director since its founding in 1897. With more than 20 years of experience in the art museum field, Elizabeth has held leadership and curatorial positions across the country at such institutions as the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art in Kansas City, the Contemporary Austin, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and the Whitney Museum of American Art, which is one of my favorites. So, Elizabeth's been recognized for her work with emerging and mid-career international contemporary artists, having commissioned several major exhibitions and projects. Prior to arriving in Syracuse, she served as executive director of Diverse Works, a nationally renowned multidisciplinary art center in Houston, where she organized projects that traveled to such important venues as the Institute of Contemporary Art in London, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, and the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles, among others. She's a native Californian who was raised in Texas, received MAs in art history and museum studies from the City University of New York. She's authored numerous exhibition catalogs and essays. She lectures widely about modern and contemporary art. She's currently serving on the board of CNY Arts and the Gustav Stickley House Foundation. And she's living in DeWitt with her husband, son, and two dogs. Personally, I have six pets, but we can talk about that later. Bob Hop, he's in his first season as the artistic director of Syracuse Stage. So welcome, welcome. Prior to coming to Central New York, Bob spent 17 seasons as the producing artistic director of Arkansas Repertory Theater in Little Rock. He's directed over 30 productions for Arkansas Repertory Theater, ranging from Hamlet to Les Mis to The Grapes of Wrath. In New York City, he directed the American premiere of Glenn Maxwell's The Lifeblood and Wolf Pit for the Phoenix Theater Ensemble. He also served for 9 seasons as the artistic director of the Obie Award-winning Jean Cocteau Repertory. His directing credits include works by Buckner, Wilder, Cocteau, Shaw, Wedekind, and the premieres of the Bentley Milhaud version of Brecht's Mother Courage and Her Children. He's held faculty positions at Pennsylvania's Dickinson College and in Arkansas at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock and Hendricks College. Bob served as the vice president of the board of directors of the Theater Communications Group and has served on funding panels for the National Endowment for the Arts, the Theater Communications Group, the New Jersey State Council of the Arts, and the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs. While in Arkansas, he was named both Nonprofit Executive of the Year and Individual Artist of the Year by the Arkansas Arts Council. So welcome to the three of you. We look forward to hearing from each of you. At the end of each of their presentations, they'll each speak, and then you'll have an opportunity for questions and discussions. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Andrea. And you know, I really want to, we need to give a big round of applause to these two. Syracuse Stage is opening their show tomorrow night, and here is the new artistic director. And I think this is Elizabeth's first time at the Thursday Morning Roundtable. I know it's not for me, but thank you so much for coming to our city. Thank you so much. So I was asked to kind of frame this discussion, you know, maybe a little bit above, like at the 10,000 foot view. And that's how I'm going to do this, to sort of look at some national trends that are occurring and talk a little bit about how that impacts perhaps locally. So I'm going to look and share a study with you that was conducted by Arts Midwest, which is a really large regional arts service organization, and the Metropolitan Group, which is a very successful agency of social change. And they conducted a study in 2015 because they're very concerned about the decreasing participation in the arts. And when they say decreasing participation, they mean people not going to the benchmark arts programs, you know, opera, museums, theater, musical theater. People not financially contributing, and no political action in support of the arts. And they took that on because our National Endowment for the Arts studies have indicated there have been decreasing participation levels over the past decade. So they wanted to come up with some strategies because the belief for us is that arts, there should be an expectation that you're participating in the arts every day, in everyday life, that there's arts participation. So anyway, they conducted this national study in 2015, and I thought it was very interesting. This was brought to my attention by Mark Golden of Golden Paints at a convening the professors and deans meet with CNY Arts twice a year at Arts and Higher Ed Summits, and this study came up as a topic of conversation. So they came up with three core questions, and they're up here on the board. And while you're reading them, I just want to talk a little bit about the fact that the first question says they wanted to have a discussion about arts and culture, but they didn't want to mention the phrase arts and culture. I know, that gets us a chuckle. But truthfully, people have a kind of resistance to hearing arts and culture. Even when CNY Arts did its study, Engage, a few years ago, we called it arts and entertainment, because a lot of people have this idea that arts and culture is very high art. It is the concerto violinist in the concert hall, and they don't participate in arts at that level. So they think, then I don't participate in arts and culture. That's not really true. So they came up with these three core questions. And here's what they found. They found, actually, that the phraseology, creative expression, had a lot more meaning for people. And that by starting conversations about creative expression, they could actually kind of drill down to arts and culture. It brings more people into the conversation, they found, because everyone feels that they have a creative expression to them. And they think that creative expression is also part of problem solving, which is not specifically about the arts, but is something that everyone is talking about valuing in the job market. And when they drilled down, you know, of course, they recognized that art is a product of creativity. And when they talked about culture, they talked about culture as being part of a lifestyle that's connected to heritage and tradition. And we're going to get back to that a little bit later. So what was the big motivator to connecting to this creative expression? Well, it was the connection as the driving force to family and friends. So we begin to understand that a lot of times participating in the arts is really about socializing and bringing our families and connecting with our friends or just to others. And they also discovered that there's recognized value in authentic experiences of other cultures. And so you can see by the size of the balloons up there, family and friends was the biggest connection. People felt that creative expression could connect them to themselves, but they thought that sometimes, you know, trying to find themselves again felt a little self-indulgent. So, again, back to the barriers. So here we have this phrase, arts and culture. And as you can see, arts are viewed as a nicety or a luxury. So when you say arts and culture, you immediately, for many people, not necessarily those in this room, but for many people, it's like, well, that's a luxury. That's not where we spend our time. They also found that people want to engage with arts and culture, but they want to participate in it, and that many cultural offerings are still very passive and observatory, and they really want to engage. And people say that if they are experiencing creative expression, that they're happier, healthier, and less stressed. So that's really important to them. Those were important motivators for them. They think that time and money is the biggest barrier to participating in arts and culture, according to this study, according to what people said. And I almost would say money and time. And let's just pause for 1 second and realize the arts are labor intensive. The costs are not going to go down particularly, because if you're going to play a piece that requires a symphony, you can't do it with just a piano. And if you have a cast of 10 or 20, you might be able to do some double casting, but basically you need to hire that many people. So the arts are expensive, and if people don't value it, if they say it's too expensive, we and our job is to increase the value of that experience where they would be willing to pay for it. Because we know that people are willing to pay a lot of money to go to the spa, to get certain sports tickets. Why not arts and culture? When they drilled down to look at who these audiences were, what they found is that younger people, women, parents of children under 18, and this is very interesting, people with children really felt that arts experiences, if they weren't important for them, were very important for their children. And this dovetails with our own study, where parents felt that arts experiences and education were important both in school and after school. And yet the study also found that 40% of secondary students, by the time kids are in high school, they're not getting any arts curriculum whatsoever in this national study. So here's a roadmap maybe to our future. These people are younger, they're more diverse, and they say that creative expression and creativity are important in their lives. Now, that's not to dismiss our enthusiastic arts and culture audiences or the arts and culture community, but this might be a way to frame the dialogue as we try to increase participation in the arts. And this is the framework that they came up with, that there's a set of core values, families, health and well-being, learning and self-improvement, that the benefits are that they are able to express themselves, they experience growth and well-being and happiness. And I think we've all heard a little bit about the happiness factor. Now, these studies will come out, you know, such and such city is ranked, you know, the fifth best city to live in the country because, and they list all of these things. There's trails to walk, there's events to attend, there's a, people are happy being there. So the happiness factor is really quite important. That's not to say that the arts groups have not always focused on creativity, because I think we have known for a long time that creative expression is important. So here's the On My Own Time program at the Everson, done in partnership with the Everson for about 40 years. And this celebrates creativity in the workforce. And I hope I can get Elizabeth to talk a little bit about the work that they're doing to expand their space for workshops and their makerspace for people to come and actually create art. Syracuse Stage, you know, has been really very successful by casting locals. And so people get to actually creatively express themselves on the main stage, To Kill a Mockingbird. The Christian choruses performing. And that, again, allows people to creatively express themselves, but it also gives us this connection to family, friends, and colleagues, which is the great motivator in attending art. Let's take it to another level and talk a little bit. Someone asked me to talk a little bit about jobs. So here's Austin, and they have an arts district. And they take this word creative and they add to it entrepreneurial, adaptable, inventive Austin. So by focusing on the fact that they have an arts district, they rebrand themselves as this wonderful place. And for the job market, isn't that what you want to hear? That the people there are inventive, creative, adaptable, inventive. And they go on to say, for people coming here, this who strive for innovation and connection, Austin's the place to come for this conference. So that's an important concept, that arts and culture on a macro level in a district can actually help rebrand the region as a vital place to live, work, and play. And more importantly, if you know there's an arts district, you can, whether you know what's going on or not, you go down and just see what's going on and participate. And if you know a region has multiple arts districts, then you come into the region, which is very good for the economy and very good for jobs in hospitality and the service sector. So CMY Arts is very interested in the creation of arts districts in all of the cities in our region, but starting out with the five biggest and then working to expand the concept of an arts and entertainment district through all kinds of Main Street revitalization projects. And I just want to connect back to, finally, the, this is important too. Oswego, as you know, we all, or many cities in our region, applied for a competitive downtown revitalization initiative, and Oswego won. And I serve on that committee in part because there was a very strong arts and culture component in their application. They plan to build a children's museum and a well-known building downtown, which connects to their heritage, a repurposing of a building long recognized. They have a strong public arts component in that to put public art in their downtown as a way to attract visitors and to stimulate visitation and participation in what's happening there. And then finally, just to say that the New York State Council on the Arts last year initiated an application for two of our centennials, the 100-year anniversary of women getting the right to vote in New York State in state elections, and the bicentennial Erie Canal. And this again, and over the next year, I think you're going to see a lot of these kinds of projects. But this again is connecting to our local heritage and culture. And as someone described this to me yesterday, we are the corridor of conscience with the women's right movement, the peace movement, the Underground Railroad, refugees settled in Oswego in World War II. There is so much here that if we work together, we really could be this corridor of conscience bringing people in, and I hope that that's what I'm going to be seeing a lot of in 2017. So thank you for giving me this time. And
good morning. Thank you for having me here today. Before I get started, and I'll be talking a lot about some of the things that Steve has previously mentioned intertwined within my talk, but before I get into it, I wanted to recognize many of our Everson supporters here this morning. I see a board member in the back. I see staff members here. I see our awesome members council members over here and our trip committee members, so I'm really pleased to see you all out here in support of the Everson. Thank you for all you do for our organization and for bringing art and culture and entertainment and all those things to our great city. I wanted to talk about some upcoming and current projects that we have going on at the Everson. I hope you've noticed a difference in the last couple of years, that there's a sense of energy and passion and community engagement with our organization. I wanted to start by talking about some of our exhibitions, a couple that are currently on view, and related to what Steve was just talking about, the centennial of women's right to vote. The Everson is on the forefront of all of these things. So we have a show currently up right now by the artist Angela Fraley, which really was put together with the idea of women's suffrage in mind. She's an artist who lives in Allentown, Pennsylvania, in New York City, and has been a strong advocate for mining art history, literature, film, popular culture to find those women's voices that have been left out of history or left out of art history or literature or have been overshadowed and bring them to the forefront. So we have a major survey of her work at the Everson that will run through the end of December, and this is one of her paintings that's in the exhibition. Titled Between Tongue and Teeth. This piece in particular takes imagery from Baroque and Rococo old master paintings and then blows it up on a grand scale, removes all the men from the pictures, of course, and is very beautiful, seductive kind of work, but has lots of layers to it as well. And there's overleafing with gold leaf on these beautiful paintings, and she's taken the pattern from a design by Candace Wheeler, who was a designer in the arts and crafts era, was a strong advocate for women being paid for their work, and that was a way for women to have autonomy in the economy. And she worked with Tiffany. She was really one of the first women to get paid for her work as a designer. So Angie's taken that pattern and blown it up into large scale. These images here really do not do Angie's work justice. You have to come and see them in person. This is another piece that she's done. She recently did a big project for the Vanderbilt Mansion in Hyde Park, New York. Some of you have probably been there. I'm sure our trip committee has been down there before, so they go lots of great places. This is a project that where she researched the people who lived or worked or visited the Vanderbilt Mansion, and she found that there are very little written documents of the women who lived there or worked there. And so she created a series of portraits based on those non-existent women. Well, they existed, but the non-existent histories of these women. So there's an entire series of these in the museum where you only see the back of their heads, their necks, and they gaze out at you, not giving you too much information, but you don't know if they're a servant, you don't know if they're a housemaid, or is it a lady of the house. So these are more intimate portraits and based more on late 19th century portrait paintings that would have been contemporaneous with the folks that lived in the Vanderbilt Mansion. In terms of engaging the local population, I have sort of a mantra of think locally but act globally. And I think Angie was a good example of that, in that we're tapping into the region's history with women's suffrage. I also wanted to tap into the local love for the Erie Canal, knowing that the bicentennial was coming up. Fortunately and unfortunately, we're ahead of the game that we're doing these projects this year. Apparently, all the NISCA funding comes in next year for these kinds of projects, so we're a little ahead of ourselves. This year, we commissioned an artist from New York City, Marie Lorenz, to travel the entire course of the Erie Canal. She started in Buffalo with our partners at the Albright Knox Art Gallery, and then paddled or rode the entire Erie Canal all the way to Albany, and then down the Hudson River all the way to Manhattan, where she ended her journey at the High Line in New York, which was one of our partners in the project. Along the way, she compiled a video. You could watch her sort of in real time in our galleries. And then in the exhibition that's on view currently, you can see a 30-minute video that she created from her journey and some of her explorations and the people that she talked to along the way, as well as some sculpture that she made as part of the project. And I should also mention that she creates her boats by hand. And various people joined her along the way on this journey. So this is Marie in the boat. But again, trying to tap into our local history, our regional history. I wanted to talk about our ceramics collection. If you didn't know this already, but maybe a lot of you already do know this, the Everson has one of the most outstanding ceramics collections in the country. We have more than 5,000 objects in it. It's encyclopedic. It started in 1916 with the purchase of 32 porcelain pieces by arts and crafts pioneer Adelaide Robineau. And we've been a powerhouse in the ceramics world ever since. We are in the process of really trying to bring that ceramics collection out into the public sphere even more. Any of you who have been to the museum in the last 30 years probably have experienced a ceramics collection on the lower level in an open study presentation. It was kind of tucked in the corner in the basement, and while that was very avant-garde at the time to present it in that open storage way, it really didn't give you the sense of scholarship and really the diversity of the collection and really highlighting what was so important about it. So we've been on a mission to really bring this out into the public forefront, make it a star of the museum's collection, a highlight of a visit to Syracuse, bring people here from all over the world to see this collection. So part of this was a grant that we received from the Luce Foundation almost 3 years ago for $230,000 to digitize a portion of our ceramics collection. And what you're seeing here is a piece in our collection that's being photographed in the round. All the images from the works that have been documented will be available online free of charge, and you can look at the objects. You can spin them around, you can look at the bottoms, you can even look inside in some cases. So it's a way to bring our ceramics collection to life for people who may not be able to experience it in the flesh, but also provide some really deep, thorough scholarship to the collection. So in addition to this, many of our documents related to the ceramics archive have been scanned and available to the public. And this is what the Ceramic Center looked like in 1986 when it initially opened. So 30 years later, we are tearing it apart and creating something entirely new. In this space, as Steve was alluding to, we will be creating new education wing in the museum with flexible classroom space and an area for people to come in and do make, you know, have classes, do makers kinds of projects and those kinds of things. So really amplifying our engagement with the community. And this is a view of our downstairs gallery from, I would say, back in the 70s or early 80s. This is where we used to present our ceramics. So it's being returned back to a ceramics gallery. We've ripped out carpet. We've been in a dust mode for the last 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and it's going to be brought to life magically by November 20th. So we are scheduled to open this to the public November 20th. We haven't made the official public announcement, so you're hearing it here first. But mark your calendars because we're really excited about this. I'm also very excited about a project that we're doing with local artist Sam Van Aken, who is a professor at Syracuse University. Some of you may have heard of this project, the Tree of 40 Fruit. Essentially, Sam grafts and sculpts trees, and it's a grove of 8 trees that will be planted outside of the museum on the corner of State and Harrison Street of these grafted trees. They are stone fruit, and they produce 40 different varieties of apricots, plums, almonds, other stone fruit, and blossom and produce fruit at different times during the spring and summer. So they're being planted this next month, and you'll start seeing them grow and blossom next year with plums, and after that we'll have other delicious things for you to sample. Coming up, our annual Festival of Trees, always a huge highlight, organized by our members' council. 10 days of excitement, performances, beautiful trees, and other decorative objects throughout the museum. It's a family tradition here in Syracuse, so I hope you'll join us for that. I also just wanted to preview a show coming up next spring, or I guess winter, Bradley Walker Tomlin, again thinking about the local and global. Bradley Walker Tomlin was born in Syracuse in 1899, I believe, and received his Bachelor's of Fine Arts degree at Syracuse University before going on to become a major member of the Abstract Expressionist Circle. Before he became one of those artists, this is an early piece that he did while here in Syracuse. He also worked for Condé Nast, doing cover illustrations and advertisements, and then later moving into Abstract Expressionism, where he was affiliated with such folks as Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning. Now, in addition to exhibitions, we do lots of other things. So I just want to talk very briefly, because I know I only have a couple minutes left. We do classes, we do family days, we do community exhibitions. So On My Own Time is one of those exhibitions. We also work with Photography and Literacy Project. And these are some kids that have participated in that in collaboration with Syracuse University. All kinds of different things. We have a very active docent program and outreach committee that goes to nursing homes, senior centers, libraries all over the city to bring art to people who may not be able to visit the museum in person. So doing slide presentations with them in addition to work hands-on activities. Community exhibitions, as I mentioned, and behind here is last year's Bricks and Blocks exhibition. It was a Lego design challenge, and we work with a lot of school groups and families to create these awesome Lego constructions. Classes and programs, we have a very innovative program called Style Engineers, trying to bring science, engineering, math, and the arts together for STEAM. These are girls, teenage girls, who are working in apparel design and including electronics and circuitry along with fashion. Family and community days are at the heart of our of the museum. We have one coming up this Saturday that I want to plug. Starts at noon until 5 o'clock. We're expecting about 500 people to come to the museum. We've got free activities, pumpkin painting, we're showing movies, and it's a great way to engage our community. Bring your children, bring your grandchildren. It's a great day for us. And just in terms of the variety, you know, we do exhibitions, but we really try a little bit of everything at the museum. We are not afraid to engage in all kinds of crazy things. So we've done line dancing out on the plaza. We do yoga in the galleries every Saturday. We've had bands outside, food trucks, and you even can look at art like she is. So lots happening. Please join us for many of the activities we have coming up, and thank you.
Good morning. How are you all doing this morning? Good. Last night, I sat in a darkened room and watched a story unfold full of lies, intrigue, and deceit. And then I turned off the debates and went back into the theater. It's hard to top reality sometimes, isn't it? But last night was the first public preview of the first production of Syracuse Stage's 44th season. And I was thrilled to be there to watch it unfold in front of hundreds of people to see my first story told on our stage. You know, I've been here in Syracuse since the 1st of July. The first thing my wife and I did was went out to the new amphitheater and watched the Symphoria 4th of July concert. And since that time, we've made it a real priority to journey around Central New York and see and experience the cultural life that really is a vibrant part of who we are. And so it's been a wonderful time here in this summer, and we appreciate the beautiful Arkansas weather that you've provided for us this fall. But it really has been a time of learning and experiencing all that Central New York has to offer. We come here with fresh eyes. And think about the change that's happening at Syracuse Stage right now. Unprecedented change in its 44-year history. We have a new artistic director. We have a new managing director, Jill Anderson, arrived just a few weeks after I did. We have a new board president, B. Gonzalez, Dean Gonzalez at Syracuse University. We have a new chairman, Fran Nichols, who many of you may know. We have a new dean at the College of VPA, Visual and Performing Arts, Michael Tick. The entire cast of characters who are charged with the life of Syracuse Stage has changed. And so we are now at a time of listening and learning. We're making some changes, some tweaks around the edges, but right now we want to get a handle on who we are so that we can decide and determine collectively and together who we're going to be. And I know as we open our 44th season, what ties that eclectic season together are great stories. And that's what I think Syracuse Stage does best, is tell great stories and bring those stories to life with the best artists from our area and from around the country that we can assemble here in Syracuse. How many of you have been down to Syracuse Stage in the last year? Oh, wow. I can just stop now and sit down. Thank you for making Syracuse Stage a part of your life. And we hope that in that eclectic array of stories that we're telling, you will find something that touches and engages you and also causes you. Like, you know, why do we do musicals like Mary Poppins? Because we want to be a part of your family's holiday tradition. We want to give you something to talk about around the family table. We want to give you stories and that become generational stories, that become stories and opportunities that you look forward to when it's the holiday time here in Syracuse. And we do plays like Disgraced and How I Learned to Drive, because we believe that those vibrant and important stories are vital to our community, and that they bring up issues that are vital and significant for us to discuss. Both plays have won the Pulitzer Prize. Both plays deserve to live on a stage. And then we have plays that are entertainment, like Ain't Misbehavin', the story of Fats Waller and some amazing jazz music, and Death Trap, a play that we may be familiar with. We've seen the Michael Caine movie, but we'll see it come to life anew on our stage as we wrap up our season. And telling great stories on our stage is not the only thing that Syracuse Stage does. We are actively engaged in the life of our community. We have educational programs that reach over 20,000 young people every year, from our student tours that go into the schools where we reach elementary school students, to a new playwriting program that we're launching for middle school kids, to engaging and immersing summer activities for high school students, to the student matinee series that brings hundreds of students from all over Central New York into our building to meet and engage with the artists who are bringing those stories to life, and artists who go out in the classroom to help the students connect the stories they see on our stage to their lives and to what they're learning in the classroom. We're also engaging the broader community. We've got a couple of new initiatives. One that I'm very interested in is our new engagement with the veterans community here in Central New York. You'll hear a lot about our growing engagement with veterans. We're starting out by telling the stories of veterans who are also students at Syracuse University. And so that's a starting point for us to start to tell those stories of people who need an opportunity to have their voice heard. And so that's another part of who we will be as we move forward. But right now, really, Jill and I are spending our time listening to you, listening to what you think about Syracuse Stage, listening to what you think works in our organization and what we can do better. And I mentioned that we just last night opened our first preview of Charles Dickens' wonderful coming-of-age story, Great Expectations. So let me take a moment to wrap up, because our guys are so good, they've already put together a video of the show. Let me give you a little sneak preview of what you're going to see when you come down and see Great Expectations, with its original score written just for this production, with six actors bringing all of Charles Dickens' amazing characters to life. We got a video for you right here.
Sitting in front of the looking glass, the strangest lady I have ever seen, or shall ever see.
What coarse hands he has, and what thick boots. You say nothing of her. What do you think of her?
Well, I don't like to say. So, you've never been to London. I was new here once myself, but now I know the moves of it.
Is it a very wicked place?
About his love for Estella, his expectations of Miss Havisham. But of course he could not.
I have been shut up in these rooms a long time. I don't know how long. You know what time the clocks keep in.
I only saw in him a much better man than I.
I'll tell you a little story as I wrap up here about the magic of live theater. So the play opens officially on Friday. This past weekend, before we had done a single run-through, as we went into tech, one of our actors had a family emergency. He had a death in the family. He needed to go home. Home for him was Northern Scotland. So our own Tim Davis Reed, who's on the faculty there at the SU Drama Department, with one day's notice, stepped into and performed last night one of the major roles in the production, and he was fantastic. And that's just an example of the incredible dynamic synergy between the Department of Drama and Syracuse Stage, and the wonderful way that the Drama Department and Syracuse Stage work together. And that's, you know, being with the students, being with the energy in that building is a phenomenal and defining characteristic of Syracuse Stage. But it was, of course, this idea that the show must go on that made us all very proud to be a part of Syracuse Stage last night. Our actor is back from Scotland, and he'll be back in the show. But for one night, we showed that really, when it comes down to pulling it all together and making it work and really understanding why the show must go on, we saw that demonstrated last night. I look forward to seeing all of you down for Great Expectations, and it's really a pleasure to be here today. Thank you.
Oh, look at all these hands up already.
Hi, folks. It's nice to see our industry so well represented up there. I just want to mention, in collaboration with Syracuse Stage, OHA does have an exhibit that's going up with the Great Expectations that people will be able to see in the lobby, learn something about our local history, and help connect you to the production. We'll also have exhibit up at the Symphoria concert this Saturday at the Landmark. So I encourage all of you to attend Great Expectations, go to the Symphoria concert, of course, the Everson, our great fine arts museum. Thanks, folks.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for this presentation. You've brought together for me, and I don't have a question, it's more of a comment, and hopefully you can respond in some way. Over the last 30 years, I've been reading Jane Orr's Earth Children series, and now in the midst of her Painted Caves piece, in which she describes the life of a prehistoric woman, beginning with Clan of the Cave Bear. Some of you may have read it. But in this last piece, there is a great deal of emphasis on the paintings in the caves of France, as well as the lifestyle of these individuals, with some focus on the use of artifacts, the bowls we saw in the Everson presentation, and even to the point of some description of drama that took place in these caves, I suppose during these long winters, in which people sang and acted out dramas. And so I'm amazed when I look at this now and during this reading of prehistoric stuff to know and understand that these things have transpired over thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And I just want to say thank you for keeping that tradition going.
Thank you. Great presentation. But this is more of a comment on the arts. I don't know if any of you were here. Well, I know the Elizabeth and Robert, you weren't here, but I believe, Stephen, you might have been here. In the late 1990s, the county legislature put a panel together to study a way to fund the arts. And at the time, one of the recommendations was to put a nickel tax on all entertainment events. And some people wanted to raise the room occupancy tax as a way to have a dedicated stream of money going to the arts. But unfortunately, the legislature basically heard from no one in the community except the Conservative Party. So I'm wondering what you think the arts community can do to be more engaged, to get people to realize how important arts are and a way to fund it. Because when you do a study like that and you hear from such a little percentage of the community, it's extremely frustrating and hard to make a good decision.
Well, I will tell you that arts and culture and heritage is funded through the county by room occupancy tax now. And every year, the county executive allocates 22% of room occupancy tax to arts and culture projects. And that's sort of a model that other counties could only aspire to. To your point, in cities and other localities, I think where Catherine Underhill from Symphoria comes from, that actually numerous counties came together and added, I think, a penny to the sales tax to create a special fund for arts in the region that really helped the region ignite. And that would be lovely to see. But what we've discovered over the past 20 years, and I think I mentioned it at the top of the study that I described, was that elected officials generally don't gain approval by supporting the arts, nor do they gain disapproval by not supporting the arts. And that's exactly why that study was done, is to find new ways to how can we engage in this conversation about what should be the expectation to have art in everyday life.
Well, just to add on to that, Steve, I think what you all do at CNY Arts and, you know, Americans for the Arts and other advocacy groups, being able to pinpoint the economic impact the arts have on a community, and you're talking about Austin, for example, and the way that they have art districts throughout the country really have shown that that draws travel and tourism to an area. If you have a strong art museum, if you have a wonderful theater, stage, music, people come and spend money here, and that's what puts money into those hotel beds and heads in beds, right? Or so, if we can show the economic impact of the arts, then I think legislators will be, you know, more sympathetic to our cause.
And I think even more than economic impact, you know, the words like innovation, entrepreneurialism, as we work to attract the business community to locate industry here, they want to know that there's an adaptable workforce. So I think it even goes beyond just, you know, the economic interest of tourism, but really reframing your locality as a desirable place to locate a business and to live. And we know that at CMY Arts, we have a regional collaborative marketing information system with a calendar, and that some companies actually download that calendar to their recruitment page on their websites where they're looking for jobs, so that when people are looking at their jobs, they can also go and see what kinds of things happen in the region. So on some level, the business community, and maybe that's where we start, really does understand the connection between arts and entertainment and having a skilled workforce.
Hi, and thank you. I was surprised to hear that the national study that Steve talked about mentioned that younger people with children were more inclined to value and attend arts and cultural events than older people, because in this city, you know, I've been going to concerts and the Everson and theater since I was in graduate school here at Syracuse University. And at that time, I was about the youngest person most of the time. And I have seen over the years mostly older people. I think that has begun to change, and I know all of you have programs that, you know, address school kids and younger people. And Symphoria is now going, you know, out of the Civic Center to places like the Most and other places that attract kids. And of course, 18 and younger are free with an adult. So I'm wondering if there are any other, you know, special programs that you haven't mentioned, or do you see that younger people are coming to these arts and cultural venues now?
Well, I can say from the Everson's perspective that, you know, we definitely have our sights on that demographic, young adults, young professionals, and families. Certainly, we've created programs, or we have had programs and are continuing to create programs to attract that demographic, from art classes to family days to Plaza Palooza over the summer, things where, you know, families can come and get together and have that kind of communal experience that Steve was talking about. So it's certainly on our mind. You know, we typically had a more traditionally older clientele, but we're really pushing to get those young 20-somethings and 30-somethings into the museum.
You're right about that. And we find at Syracuse Stage, you know, we create a lot of surround activities to make the experience of coming to Syracuse Stage more than just about coming and sitting in the theater for 2 hours, whether it's, you know, our craft beers or foods, or making it, dropping the barriers that real and perceived that people see as obstacles to engaging in the arts. And also I've found that, you know, I've moved here into Syracuse, and my wife and I live downtown. And the vibrancy of downtown, which I understand is a more recent phenomenon, the sort of the restoration, the reactivation of downtown, we see that movement, too, influencing the audience at Syracuse Stage. The more vibrant our downtown can be, which is being populated by both empty nesters and young people, the more life we see at Syracuse Stage. And you're right, we do see our average audience member reflects the audience here in this room. But it's incumbent upon us
to be out in the community, to encourage people to come to us, and also to take our work beyond the walls of our theater. Because if we aren't out in the community, and if we aren't creating events that engage people of all ages, our lives, you know, we won't see another 44 years. So what you're talking about is the question we wrestle with every day.
I want to thank our panelists very much for coming today. Please join me in thanking them.